Turkish president holds his last election rally in Istanbul as he heads towards the biggest challenge to his 20-year rule. Ukraine says Russian troops have temporarily eased attacks in and around the flashpoint city of Bakhmut to regroup and strengthen their capabilities. And tens of thousands of Serbs take to the street of Belgrade in an anti-government protest triggered by two mass shootings that left at least 18 people dead. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Now, the Turkish presidential candidates wrap up their campaign just ahead of a runoff to be held Sunday. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has urged people to vote in a way that could allow the legislature and executive to work together. He also questioned his rival Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu's ability to function without a parliamentary majority if he wins. Kılıçdaroğlu, meanwhile, addressed supporters in Istanbul as well and touched on what he called serious economic problems. He also said the situation is not bright in Turkey. The economy is a major issue for voters as inflation is soaring in the past couple of years and it's triggered a cost of living crisis. The Turkish lira greatly lost its value as well throughout this time. Just on Friday, it plunged to a record low of 20 against the U.S. dollar. Our correspondent in Istanbul, Rashan Saglam, earlier joined us with more details on how the Turkish presidential runoff is to be held while offering some insight on what's going on inside the minds of first-time voters.
Well, we will open the ballots at 8 a.m. It will close at 5 p.m. At 6, the ballots will be gathered. At 7, the counting will start. At 9, we are going to getting numbers. And at 12 midnight, we should have the approximate result if there was no need to hide the result for security reasons, because everyone in the country is saying that the situation this time is a little bit more tense and the government does not want any problem to be happening. So they might delay the results until the next morning. More than 64 million Turkish citizens will be casting their votes. And in the previous elections, we saw some 6 million from the youth casting their votes for the first time. And they were very excited about that because most of them wanted to see a change in the country. Now, for the past 2 weeks, we have been seeing them both campaigning very hard to try and harvest the undecided votes. We have some undecided votes, and we have the votes that went to Sinan Ogan, the third presidential candidate, who is not going to be in the runoff now. This election is really important for Turkey because of the economic situation that the country is going through. We are facing the worst crisis in the cost of living in the country. The lira for the first time is 20 against the US dollars. The two candidates, they're both promising better economy, better economic strategies. They're both promising to lower the inflation rate. They're both promising the people a better future.
The Iranian president has warned the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, against the Western government's attempts to sow discord among its member states. Ebrahim Raisi made the remarks during a meeting with OPEC Secretary General Haitham Al-Gais in Tehran. Raisi said that OPEC needs to work to promote unity within the organization to foil such plots, adding that Iran is ready to uplift cooperation with the organization. Now, meanwhile, Al-Gais hailed Iran for its constructive cooperation in OPEC, saying that Tehran has always worked to foster unity among other members. He noted that unity within the organization will also bring calm to the volatile market. Journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas says rise of the Eurasian axis has caused some tectonic changes in West Asia.
Well, it's quite clear that there are seismic changes going on in West Asia, and they're largely impacted by the rise of the Eurasian axis. Saudis seem to want in on what's going on there and are very, very nervous, it seems, about the West's intentions and their long-term, if you like, interests being not so clean for the Saudis. So this is causing a lot of very, very rapid changes. And coming to what I was saying, the Americans are responding with threats. For instance, there's something called NOPEC that they've triggered, a sort of legal process where they want to be able to seize OPEC assets in the U.S. for instance. The U.S. shale response, for instance, it created higher prices, but it slowed down various elements within the actual production of oil. But the Americans have also, of course, used the International Energy Agency to release oil stocks last year as well. That didn't go down well with the Saudis. So there's a war going on here. Quite clearly, there is an oil tussle, a struggle going on. And it is, and the backdrop to it, of course, is the Eurasian Axis versus the American imperialist hold on West Asia. And it seems as though West Asia generally now is moving much more rapidly towards the Russians, the Chinese, and indeed the Iranians.
At least three people are killed and several injured in clashes between Iranian troops and Taliban forces along the border between the two countries. Iranian media said the two border guards were killed and two injured after Taliban opened fire at a checkpoint along the Iran-Afghanistan border. Taliban officials also said one of their forces was killed and one wounded. They said the situation, though, is now under control. Iran's police chief ordered border guards to resolutely defend the country against anyone who tries to trespass or encroach on the borders. Police chief has also warned Afghan authorities are responsible for any action which is unwise and in violation of international law. And I welcome everyone up to the News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Ukraine says Russian troops have temporarily eased attacks in and around the flashpoint city of Bakhmut to regroup and strengthen their capabilities. Now, Russia says its forces have completely taken over the city, but Kiev says it still controls pockets of Bakhmut. Battle for the city has been the longest and bloodiest of the war. Capture will bring Russia slightly closer to its goal of controlling the entire region of Donetsk. Meanwhile, Ukraine says it will soon launch a highly anticipated counteroffensive. Ukrainian defense officials said the push could start as soon as tomorrow or ultimately by the end of the week. Ukraine says the offensive aims to recapture territory taken by Russia since the start of the war. Joining us now for the program is Matthew Everett, a senior fellow at American University in Moscow, joining us out of Montreal, and Christopher Helali, researcher and political analyst, joining us out of Verchères, Vermont. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program now. I guess we'll start there in Vermont with you, Christopher. Hope you're safe and doing well. Your initial thoughts on this thing becoming protracted. We had one of Vladimir Putin's top aides saying this thing could possibly be drawn out decades, maybe even. I mean, if this thing is protracted, tell us some of your thoughts on the ramifications involved, especially for the Europeans.
The ramifications are enormous, and this is what was revealed in the recent leaks on Discord from the young man Teixeira, who shared top secret intelligence from the United States and Western allies that mentioned that this is going to become a protracted conflict, that there is no easy path and solution. And of course, at the same time, you have the Russian Foreign Ministry saying to the Ukrainians that there are some ways that we can achieve a settlement, and those include, for example, having Russian as a language, recognizing the rights of minorities, recognizing the new geopolitical situation and border situation, as well as not joining the EU and NATO. But of course, the Ukrainians want to protract the war because that's what their Western backers are pushing for. So there, you have to imagine that there are thousands of shipments of arms going daily from many, many NATO countries and their allies to Ukraine to continue to do this. And we recently heard from Lindsey Graham in a meeting with Zelensky saying it's a good thing that Russians are dying and that's what we're paying for. So it looks like the Russians are willing to go to the negotiating table. The Ukrainians are not, and they're willing to destroy their entire country and have their people sacrifice on the altar of war to further Western aims. So I see a long protracted war that we're entering that phase at this point, and I see a lot of devastation in the future because the West simply does not want to negotiate and recognize Russia's concerns.
And thank you, Christopher, there. Matthew, welcome to the program. Now, Matthew, we're seeing the West slowly starting to get more and more sophisticated in the kind of weapons they're giving the Ukrainians. There's talk of F-16s now. You very well know every time we hear about missiles being given to the Kiev forces, we're hearing about missiles that could hit longer ranges. Possibly now there's talk of 500-kilometer missiles that could hit inside of Russian territory. Is this thing, in your point of view, going to blow into something that's going to involve more than just Russia and Ukraine, ultimately?
Well, that is the tightrope that is being walked right now. And as you pointed out, these 500-kilometer range missiles that are being proposed from the German side, the Taurus projectiles, do bring Moscow into striking distance. The F-16s are, you know, these would be equipped on F-16s. There's other missiles like Storm Shadows that have been supplied by UK. In most of these cases so far, we've seen Russia handle it pretty well. I mean, the Storm Shadows recently were shot down by Russian defenses very effectively. And Mark Milley even had to make a point. And Mark Milley is no representative of sanity by any measure. But even Milley himself had to state that the F-16s would be completely useless when dealing with the thousands of fourth and fifth generation Russian fighters capable of outmaneuvering them a thousand ways from Sunday. So, I mean, on the one hand, Russia has a very, very high-level capacity to respond to many of the best technologies that are being put forth from the United States and from the broader collective West. At the same time, the Kiev regime is run as a puppet regime, and unfortunately, some of these puppets are basket cases, many of them are, who have all openly stated their desires not only to join NATO, but also to host nuclear warheads that would be owned by the United States. This is what Zelensky openly stated a week before the military intervention began last year. So obviously, yeah, this could derail, this could snowball in a variety of ways, similarly as we'd seen in World War I, which nobody expected, except in World War I, there were no nuclear warhead technologies.
Thank you both for joining us on the program. Matthew Everett there joining us out of Montreal, and Christopher Helali joining us from Vershaw, Vermont. Thank you for tuning in. That's it for this segment of your News Review program, and bye-bye for now. Tens of thousands of Serbs take to the streets of Belgrade in an anti-government protest over two mass shootings that left 18 people dead. Now, the crowd surrounded a compound housing the state broadcaster, calling for the Serbian president to resign. They also are demanding more media freedom, and this was the fourth such protest organized by opposition parties. They blame the government for failing to rein in the media that's, they say, promoted violence and acted against criminal elements in society. No, they want the government to act against criminal elements in society. Now, the government has denied opposition parties' allegations, accusing them of staging these protests for nothing more than political gain. Now, on May 3rd, a young boy killed nine students and a security guard in Belgrade in the first school mass shooting in Serbia. Then a day later, a 21-year-old man killed eight people just outside the city. French police brutality against protesters continues to occur, and one group which knows plenty about the subject are the Yellow Vest anti-government protesters. They're still gathering every Saturday nationwide, and they're doing so despite regular harassment by police and judges, as they have proclaimed. Rami Mazahari has your details from Paris.
When climate activists were tear-gassed, abused, and arrested by police in Paris, the Western mainstream media broadcast shock and alarm at state brutality towards nonviolent protesters. Many of France's Yellow Vests were glad the subject was reported upon, but the group, which has been subject to more French police brutality than any group in recent memory, wonders why their weekly protests and mistreatment are still under a media blackout.
Chaque samedi, bientôt cinq ans.
Every Saturday for nearly 5 years, the Yellow Vests have been in the streets. In the big cities and the small towns, we make our legitimate demands for democratic and economic rights, and we won't stop until we get them.
Many were shocked this month when a woman who was not participating in a 2019 Yellow Vest demonstration and had been shot in the neck by a tear gas grenade was just judged to be co-responsible for her injuries. The judge said that the mother, who had gotten lost in a strange city while visiting her daughter, should have known that serious incidents had occurred at recent protests. The decision refused to find fault with the state's actions, seems to negate a citizen's right to travel freely, and will likely scare many away from even observing a yellow vest protest.
Un état totalitaire.
We aren't in a dictatorship, but in a totalitarian situation. The state wants everybody to keep quiet and to agree with whatever they say. This lack of democracy, why the yellow vests began in the first place. It wasn't over just gas prices. This woman's situation is one dramatic situation, but there are so, so many others like her.
On June 6th, a million-person march is expected, the 15th this year, in the ongoing fight against a 2-year hike to the retirement age by presidential decree. Police brutality is expected to be even more rampant than at the previous such march on May 1st.
Pour leur physique de venir en manifestation.
The people are afraid for their own physical safety when they come to a protest now. There are so many arrests, so much violence, and constant tear gas. This is the reason why the number of people joining us dropped, even as our national problems keep growing worse.
Besides their Saturday marches, the yellow vests are present at seemingly every public protest in France, and often around Europe as well. They regularly contend that they are willfully ignored by the government and media because the basis of their movement is economic and political redistribution. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
The White House has found another $3 billion for Ukraine aid. U.S. officials previously claimed they overestimated the amount of U.S. aid sent to Kiev by several billion dollars. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted, the White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan has offered an explanation for a massive accounting error recently spotted in U.S. assistance to Ukraine, arguing the blunder is actually good news as it means even more American tax dollars can be sent to Kiev. During an interview with CNN's Jake Tapper recently, Sullivan was pressed to explain the Pentagon's bizarre admission that it had found an extra $3 billion in Washington's aid budget for Ukraine, with the host calling it a hell of an accounting error. Asked whether the mistake suggested a lack of oversight on the 37 separate arms shipments and other assistance sent to Kiev since last year, the senior White House official insisted that at the end of the day, not one penny of U.S. dollars will have gone missing or have been misallocated. That is not a waste of that $3 billion. It is simply a tally of how much military equipment we have given them, and the way that the Pentagon was counting it was what's the replacement cost for the equipment we provide rather than just the actual cost of that equipment, Sullivan explained, adding, Once you make that adjustment, it turns out we have an additional $3 billion that we can spend to provide even more weapons to Ukraine. He acknowledged the Pentagon should have provided the correct figure in terms of the accounting up front, but argued that U.S. taxpayers can be confident that this money is being spent effectively and appropriately. The admission of the sizable accounting error last week follows repeated criticisms from some Republican lawmakers over U.S. military aid to Ukraine, which has topped $37 billion since the Russia-Ukraine conflict last year. Recently, 19 GOP representatives and senators penned a letter to President Joe Biden urging for an end to the largesse, citing dangerous tensions with Moscow. The lawmakers said they were deeply concerned that the trajectory of U.S. aid to the Ukrainian war effort threatens further escalation and lacks much-needed strategy clarity, adding that there is no end in sight and no clear strategy to bring this war to a close. Despite those complaints, however, most lawmakers continue to back indefinite military aid to Kyiv, with the Republican head of the U.S. House Intelligence Committee, Representative Michael Turner, recently declaring that there is overwhelming support for continued assistance within the legislature. Russia has long warned that the military aid, training, intelligence, and other support offered to Kyiv has already made the U.S. and its allies de facto parties to the crisis. According to earlier reports, the U.S. Department of Defense has discovered an accounting error that could result in more weapons, ammunition, and equipment being available for Ukraine than was previously expected. Reuters reported recently the agency cited a Senate aide and a Pentagon official, both anonymous, who said that the U.S. military had overestimated the value of some of its hardware that was sent to Kyiv by around $3 billion, implying that less money has been spent on arming Ukraine than was previously calculated. The Pentagon used the current replacement cost for equipment taken from its stocks rather than factoring in the original purchase price and depreciation. According to the agency's source, the DoD is reportedly taking steps to notify Congress of the accounting adjustment. Senator Roger Wicker, the ranking Republican on the Senate Armed Services Committee, told Reuters that the Pentagon made a major mistake that could underestimate future needs of NATO allies. "Our priority should be a Ukrainian victory. Unilaterally altering military aid calculations is an attempt at deception and undermines this goal," said Senator from Mississippi. However, the accounting confusion may translate into even more supplies to the Kyiv government, according to the agency. Recently, the U.S. was reportedly down to only $6 billion in Ukraine aid from $48 billion approved by U.S. Congress in December. Securing more funding is difficult at the moment due to the standoff over the national debt ceiling. Washington's overall efforts to send weapons to Kyiv consist of two tracks. The Presidential Drawdown Authority, PDA, allows the Pentagon to send material from its own stockpiles to the tune of $21.1 billion so far in 37 separate packages. The separate Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative, USAI, has the U.S. government pay the military industry to make new weapons and ammunition, much of which has yet to arrive. According to Reuters, the Pentagon sent a memo to the Army, Navy, Air Force, and the Marine Corps on March 31st, clarifying how the value of the equipment should be calculated. The anonymous Pentagon official speaking to the agency used the example of 155-millimeter artillery shells, of which more than 1.5 million were sent to Kiev. While each costs about $800 today, the cost over several decades averages out to much less. Ukraine has repeatedly said its successes on the battlefield heavily depends on the aid from the West. According to Russian military estimates, the U.S. and its allies had delivered over $100 billion worth of weapons and supplies to Ukraine by December 2022. Moscow has warned Washington that this elevates the risk of direct confrontation. However, the U.S. and NATO have insisted that arming Kiev does not actually make them a party to the conflict. According to Axios, it was not immediately clear which weapons had been mistakenly overestimated. The U.S. Defense Department officials were still trying to determine the total overvaluation. The U.S. has in total committed more than $30.4 billion in security assistance to Ukraine since the beginning of the Biden administration, per a Pentagon statement. The website of Hill also reported House Armed Services Chairman Mike Rogers and House Foreign Affairs Chairman Michael McCaul blasted the Pentagon for the mistake. They wrote in a joint statement, "The revelation of a $3 billion accounting error discovered 2 months ago and only today shared with Congress is extremely problematic." The chairman continued, "These funds could have been used for extra supplies and weapons for the upcoming counteroffensive instead of rationing funds to last for the remainder of the fiscal year." While the oversight has led to questions, it also means there are more U.S. dollars for Ukraine than previously believed, as questions mount over whether security aid is drying up. Washington approved $113 billion for Ukraine in 2022, about $47 billion of which is directly related to providing Ukraine with defense needs.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Fadai and Sheikh Rouhani. Sheikh Fadai, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum to you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Today we want to talk about an important topic. That is the topic of, can say, Imamzada, the descendants or offsprings of the holy Imams. We know that all across the world, especially in the Shiite lands, Islamic Republic of Iran, Iraq, Syria, and so many other Muslim Shiite lands, there are so many holy shrines which are attributed to the descendants and the offsprings of the holy Imams. So many people pay visits, pay homage to these holy places. They respect them very much. Great domes and Islamic art and architecture is built around them, and they are very much respected, especially in Iran, Iraq, and Syria. Now, we want to talk about first the definition of an Imamzada. Who is an Imamzada? Why are they respected? And why at all building a dome across the grave? Sheikh Fadai, let's start with you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, Imamzada in our belief, Islamic belief, are the children and sometimes descendants of our imam.
Yes.
We respect them because of the respect that we pay to our imam. It mm-hmm. means that if you want to understand what is the reason for that respect, we should refer to the position of imam in our Islamic belief.
Okay.
You know, in our belief, imams are the main reason of guidance and hidayah in Islam. In the famous hadith Saghalan, we have Kitab Allah wa Itrati.
Yes.
It means Quran and Itra, which is our imam. These are the two causes of hidayah and direction. So our imams are the real interpreters of Quran.
Yes.
And in our some hadiths, they are called Quran and Natiq. It means the speaker Quran.
Yes.
Because Quran is just a text. It doesn't speak to you.
Mm-hmm.
You have to make it speak. And imams are the speakers.
Yes.
So our imams are the real leaders of Islam.
Yes.
Because of this position, this high position,
okay.
we respect their children.
Okay.
So it means that we respect them. But we should pay attention that it's not just because of the family relationship.
Mm-hmm. The blood relation.
Yeah, it's not just because of that. Because we do not accept all the children and descendants of imam.
This is important. Sorry.
Yes.
Because we know out of the religion of Islam, for example, we have some kingdoms or the dynasties or the family trees, which we can say from father to the son or to the daughter. This blood relation is important. But here,
no.
You mean blood relation is important, but not all of them.
You know, okay. the main reason, as I told you, is the respect for imam.
Yes.
But for him, the imamzada,
yes.
First of all, we consider individual characteristics,
uh-huh.
whether he is a good person or a bad one,
mm-hmm.
whether he is in the way of hidayah or not. Some of the imamzada themselves, they were not in the correct way of haq.
Okay.
For example, we have Ja'far Kazzab,
yes.
the son of Imam Hadi.
Yes.
And the uncle of Imam Zaman,
okay.
Who rejected the position of Imam Zaman and
yes.
who wanted to steal the position of Imamah.
Uh-huh.
So we do not accept these kind of Imamzada just because of that blood relationship,
okay.
like the kingdoms or not.
So you here, Imamzada, of course, refers to two concepts. Number one, the very offsprings of the imams, mm-hmm. and the second one, imamzada, nowadays referred to those who have holy shrines or holy domes, mm-hmm. okay, at the place.
You know, that okay. domes and place are built for them because of that position.
Okay.
It means that we should consider two positions. First,
yes.
his position,
mm-hmm.
whether he was a very good leader for yes. the Shia at that time or
yes.
not. And second, the position of his father or fathers,
okay.
the imams.
That's right.
For example, the most famous one and the most respected one in Imamzada, as Shia knows, are Hazrat Abbas,
yes,
and Hazrat Abdul Azim,
yes.
in the Ray, Tehran, and Hazrat Masuma, Lady Masuma in Qom Dawah. Why they are the most important one and respected one? Because they themselves
okay.
were some unique people.
Mm-hmm.
So we respect them not just because of their fathers.
Yes,
we respect their fathers. And we show this respect
okay.
to them, but we consider their characteristics as well.
And some of them directly and some of them indirectly, as you said, like Abdul Azim al-Hassani, refer to the progeny of Prophet Muhammad and the infallible imams. That's all right. But why in the places like, for example, Iran, we can say Iraq and Syria, but mostly in Iran, there are so many of these holy shrines and imams that has attributed them. Was there any historical reason for that, Sheikh Rouhani?
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As it was rightly mentioned, that the A'imma alayhim salatu wa salam, or the Ahlul Bayt, were the same as the Holy Quran
okay.
in the view of Tashayyu and Shiite reading of Islam. So that's why Tashayyu paid a lot, lots of respect to the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salatu wa salam, and also the children of Ahlul Bayt. So that's why, because in Iran, we've had like Shiite political systems or kingdoms, and that's why the people paid lots of respect to the Ahlul Bayt and to the children of Ahlul Bayt. But if we search, for example, about the children of Ahlul Bayt, we may find a lot of Imamzada in other areas as well.
Yes.
It is possible.
Yes.
But since most of the people of Iran are Shia.
Yes.
So they are the followers of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. That's why they pay more respect.
That's right.
To the children of Ahlul
Bayt. And is it so that, for example, in some specific time of the history, some of these offspring escaped from the oppression of the rulers in different lands, and they came, for example, to Iran to find amnesty?
Yes, of course. Yeah, after the events of Karbala, most of the children of Ahlul Bayt left the Arab Peninsula, left Iraq for Khorasan, for Iran, for many other areas.
Okay.
And they were they went to different areas and they died there. And that's why in those places that majority of the people were Shia, they built this beautiful dome on them and and they respected a lot them. But in some other areas where majority of the people were Sunni, of course there are still Imamzadas, but they are not that much well known.
Yes.
But they are still, for example, if you go to Afghanistan, to Pakistan, to Central Asia, there are Imamzadas there, brothers of Hazrat Masumah.
Yes.
We have them in Herat and many other areas.
Really?
Yeah, okay. Of course. But since the majority of the people there are Sunni, so of course they are not that much well-known as they are in Iran.
Okay.
So it would be like a kind of, it goes to the culture of the people in Iran because they pay respect a lot to the Ahlul Bayt.
And also the political powers of the time were very important. For example, when the Buyids, Ali Buyid, were ruling over Iran, in northern part of Iran, and the Shiite dynasties were finding power over there, so many of the offsprings and descendants of the holy imams fled from their own lands to that part, So in the northern Iran, you can find so many of these imamzadas over there. That's right.
That's an important subject. You know, we have to consider that, as my brother mentioned, in other countries, they don't pay a lot of attention to imamzada.
Yes.
And, of course, there are a lot, like here. But instead, here in Iran, we can acknowledge that sometimes we paid much attention, more than enough.
Yes.
As you mentioned, in north of Iran, Gilan and Mazandaran, we have thousands of places called Imamzadeh. And it is clear that all of them are not that Imamzadeh that we say.
How we can distinguish them?
There, you know, there
is there any specific field of study, for example?
Yes, it is. Okay. Yes, you know, all the children and fathers are saved in the history. We call it Shajar-e-Name.
Family tree.
A family tree.
Yes.
And we have here, we have an organization called in Iran, Oghaf.
Yes.
You know, they are the authority for that. They should check it and they should admit that this is a Imamzada. You know, in Oghaf, we have two titles, shrines, holy shrines.
Yes.
And Bug'a, it means just some place for a Sayyid who was a great person in that village. A Sayyid one.
So
not
was,
that Imamzada.
Finally, a Sayyid's lineage, if it is truly known, goes back to an Imam,
Yes.
But it is not as holy as, for example, Hazrat al-Masumah or Hazrat al-Abbas.
You know, you know, the space between this Imamzada and the father, which is Imam, shouldn't be so long. For example, maybe more than 50 fathers between this child and the Imam exist here. We don't call this Imamzada. As we have a lot of Sayyid nowadays in Iran, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, we don't call all of them Imamzada. And of course, it has some bad results.
Yes.
In Islam.
Here in this regard, I think the Ziyarat Nama or the Ziyarat text issued by an infallible Imam is a very distinguishing line. For example, for Hazrat Ali al Akbar, Hazrat al Masumah, Hazrat al Abbas, we have authentic Ziyarat Nama or Ziyarat text. But for some of them, we have still ziyara, but it is not from an side of infallible Imam. So we can categorize them into, for example, the best category, the good category, the middle one. For example, Shah Chiragh, Zayd ibn Ali, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Hadi. You know, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Hadi is a specific case in Iraq because so many of the Sunni population also refer to his place. That's all right. Okay, Sheikh Rouhani. So, but still it has its own effect on the public culture of the Shiite lands. I mean, these Imamzadas have, you know, people refer to these Imamzadas. Through them, they pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes, of course. One thing that is really interesting in Iran is this, that when the people, for example, go to spend their leisure time or free times, yes, they can go, for example, to different places.
Yes.
And they can do each and everything, for example. Yes, yes. But when they go to an Imamzada,
yes,
a beautiful place, yes, like Imamzada,
yes,
to pay ziyara and also to spend that day there, uh-huh, due to the respect to that Imamzada, uh-huh, they control themselves.
Okay,
you know, it has a very good, like, spirituality in
spiritual
that place, yes,
effect on them, yes.
And that is, I think it helps the culture of the people to perfect,
uh-huh,
to improve.
Spiritually.
Yes, the spiritually, yes, yes, because, okay, for example, young ladies are there, young boys are there.
Yes.
When they see the holy shrine of the Imamzada,
yes,
you know, they try
to
respect.
They have to
get
in with,
yeah,
full hijab.
Of course.
Respect them.
They observe,
etiquettes,
yeah,
are,
they would
are
be
observed,
very much careful,
right,
very much cautious,
right,
about,
yeah,
each and everything.
Okay.
I think it from cultural perspective, it's really nice. It's,
uh-huh,
really interesting. But if you go to the other Islamic countries,
yes,
you cannot find such kind of places.
Mm-hmm.
There are parks, for example, to spend your free times, but you are free to do whatever, you know, like if you go to the Arab countries or to other,
yes,
countries.
Yes, yes.
But I think in Iran, it is really good. It is really interesting and beneficial for the people, even when they go to spend their free times.
Yes.
They are, these imamzadas reminding them of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's right.
They pay ziyarah. They do, for example, Islamic, mm-hmm, rituals there. And also they spend their free times enjoying their free times. I think it's culturally, it's very good. It's very nice.
That's all right. So many of these imamzadas all across the world, Qasim ibn Musa in Hilla, Zayd ibn Ali in Kufa, Iraq, Mir Sayyid Ali in Tajikistan. This is, again, a famous one. Fatima Sughra or Bibi Haybat is another name, for example, in Azerbaijan. Imamzada Zainab in Afghanistan, Herat, and Yahya ibn Zayd in Afghanistan,
yeah,
Juzjan or Sarpol. These are some of the famous, we can say, imamzadas, which need its own studies, I think. There are some specific people, some specialized people, whose expertise is to study about this lineage. About is it whether, does it back, for example, to a Sayyid or not? Does it back to a holy imam or not? Okay? Anything missed? Sheikh Fadai?
An interesting point about going to Imamzada is that, you know, ziyara, mm-hmm, generally means try to be humble.
Mm-hmm.
This humility will improve our worship in God.
Yes.
You know, because arrogance is the other side.
Mm-hmm.
The more you get far from arrogance in front of God, the better abd you can be.
Okay.
You know, going to Imamzada, it's just a practice.
Yes.
Practicing how to be humble.
Yes.
When you go to Imamzada, you respect him, you
respect
do some
them,
ziyara.
Right.
You know, because we don't have access to all imam, for example,
yes,
in Iran. We,
yes,
just,
yes,
have,
yes,
one imam,
yes,
Imam Reza. Or I don't know, in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Azerbaijan, they don't have any imam,
yes,
buried,
no,
them. Just Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Iran.
Yes.
So if you want to practice that humility,
mm-hmm,
by the means of ziyara, imamzadas,
yes,
are the best means
places,
to,
right,
do that. So it is a way to get close to God.
Mm-hmm.
So that is spiritually can improve us as abd.
Yes, that's all right. Nice places in order to stop by, have a spiritual refreshment,
yes,
okay? Sometimes the tourists,
yeah,
that come, for example, from the other lands to the holy city of Qom, for example, can say, go and pay visit to these holy shrines and imamzadas. People from far land, for example, Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, here and there, come and pay visits based on the study that they have, for example, that this might be a descendant of an holy imam. Okay, that's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Fadai and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the concept of imamzadah, the descendant or the offspring of an holy imam. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listener, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
I know that you could easily take away everything you've given me, and I try to remember not to take anything for granted.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. Please
Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.ir. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah. Ya Allah, ya Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you by my side. I wish to be close, close to you.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
German conservatives are waging a crusade against the Muslim civil society. Last month, center-right and far-right parties in Germany proposed a motion to reinstate an expert group to surveil the country's Muslim population. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote in this regard, it was one of the latest initiatives of the German conservatives in the midst of the election campaign in 2021, a crusade against organized Muslims in the name of fighting the specter of the so-called political Islamism. After losing the election and withdrawing from the government following a 16-year tenure, the Christian Democratic Union not only continues to support anti-Muslim policies, but has doubled down on this stance. In a position paper published in April 2021 and dedicated to fighting what has been dubbed political Islam, the party proposed to harden its stance towards surveilling, limiting, and potentially cracking down on Muslim civil society. Members on the party's European, national, and regional levels are promoting anti-Islam stances. The more recent trends are even more worrying. After a coalition between the Social Democrats, the Greens, and the Liberals formed a new government in December 2021, a pilot project of the Christian Democratic Parties, the Christian Democratic Union for Germany, CDU, and the Christian Social Union, CSU, The establishment of the expert group on political Islamism was not renewed. The group, launched by the Ministry of Interior, included proponents of anti-Muslim policies. The group's focus was initially to conduct research and analyze so-called political Islam, a notion that is not only very vague, but has also served to legitimize the targeting and repression of Muslim civil society in Germany. While some parliament members opted to bring an end to this group, it was not long before several of its members, such as Susan Schroeder and Crocide, alongside other anti-Muslim authors like Heiko Heinisch, protested loudly in the media to no avail. As a last resort, the center-right CDU-CSU, which had launched the expert group, initiated a debate in Germany's national parliament, the Bundestag. On March 16th, the CDU-CSU, along with the notorious anti-Muslim and far-right Alternative for Germany, AfD, proposed a motion for the reinstatement of the expert group. The AfD had come to power as a belated successful anti-Muslim political party, following the footsteps of parties such as France's National Rally, previously known as National Front, and Austria's Freedom Party. In the past, the CDU and CSU had applauded the now former Austrian Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, who had implemented the Islam Act, which aimed at a stricter financial oversight of all religious Muslim organizations. Most importantly, when these politicians speak of Islamism, they do not mean a fringe group of Muslims, but the vast majority of religiously organized Muslims. The annual report of Germany's intelligence service, the Federal Office for the Protection of the Constitution, has shown over the past two decades that a majority of Muslim organizations are included in this category, claiming that they present themselves outwardly as open, tolerant and open to dialogue, while anti-democratic and totalitarian tendencies continue to exist within the organizations. In addition, the German police forces in general have come under scrutiny after it was revealed that 17% of police personnel support openly racist statements, such as, they say, "The many Muslims sometimes make me feel like a stranger in my own country and I would have problems with Roma being in my area." This is not to speak of the structural challenges that such views of organized Muslims would present. In this vein, during the parliamentary deliberations, MP Christian Wirth, AfD, argued that 74% of all mosques belong to political groups, clearly showing that this campaign is aimed at a large segment of organized Muslims in Germany. Members of the governing coalition, such as Lamia Kador of the Greens, conducted the CDU-CSU, saying that they want Muslims without Islam, and calling attention to their silence in March on the United Nations International Day against Islamophobia. Besides the call for reinstating the expert group and pushing for more financial control and surveillance, the AfD even called for funding and establishing chairs for research and teaching courses on political Islam at public universities and academic institutions. Such an invention would only further entrench and institutionalize the witch hunt against practicing Muslims. This is again one of the recommendations that were initially presented in the CDU-CSU's position paper back in 2021. While the current German federal government is not following in the footsteps of the CDU-CSU's policies targeting Muslims, parties on the right are closing ranks. In regard to anti-Muslim policies, there is an increasing proximity of the center-right, CDU-CSU, and the far-right, FAD. Meanwhile, Anadolu agency reported that Germany's Muslim community have called for a more determined stance against Islamophobia, saying Muslims continue to experience prejudice, hate crimes, and discrimination in their daily lives. The anniversary of Church Christ Mosque attacks painfully reminds us that the stirring up prejudices and hatred against Muslims do not stop at words, but they can be carried out into action, the president of the Central Council of Muslims in Germany said in a statement. Ayman Maziak said, "This also makes it clear that we have to take much more determined stand against Islamophobia in our society, even if it's sometimes hypocritically portrayed as the criticism of Islam." On March 15, 2019, an Australian white supremacist shot dead 51 Muslim worshippers and wounded 40 others at two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand. Last year, the UN designated March 15th as the International Day to Combat Islamophobia. Mazie called on the German government to take concrete steps to address the problem and reiterated the Muslim community's demand to appoint a commissioner to combat Islamophobia. Germany has witnessed growing racism and Islamophobia in recent years, fueled by the propaganda of far-right groups and parties, which have exploited the refugee crisis and attempts to stoke fear of immigrants. Authorities registered at least 272 Islamophobic crimes in 2022, including verbal and physical assaults, threatening letters, and arson attacks targeting mosques. A country of over 84 million people, Germany has the second largest Muslim population in Western Europe after France. It is home to nearly 5 million Muslims, according to official figures.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.